change around my team. Yeah, we off the leash. You can look us in the eyes, see we have peace. Black and gold, that's the colors when we go to war. When we step up on that field, you gon' hear my roar. We them Tiger Cats, we them Tiger Cats. We them Tiger Cats, we them Tiger Cats.
Yeah, nobody hitting harder, better keep your guard up. Cause with everything we draw, we can score it when we wanna.
Welcome to Podski Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham.
So, Mike, the Canadian Football League draft has come and gone. The Ticats selected 8 players last Tuesday in the annual pick fest that we get. They took Laval offensive lineman Nathaniel Dumoulin-Degay, I think is how you pronounce his name, with their first pick, which was 7th overall. They went with a Wilfrid Laurier defensive lineman, Luke Brubacher, Brubacher, Brubacher. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I see Brubacher. I think Brubacher. I guess having German friends makes me think that's perhaps a German name. I don't know, but they took him in the 2nd round. And then they selected Daniel Bell out of Mount Allison and Matthew Peterson out of the University of Alberta in the 4th round. UBC linebacker Ryan Baker in the 5th. Peterson's U of A teammate, defensive back Jonathan Guastini, I think, Guastini. Again, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Took him in the 6th round. They added University of Saskatchewan offensive lineman John Cordes in the 7th round, and then ended their draft by taking another player out of UBC, this time linebacker Mitchell Townsend in the 8th round. So that's a lot of new players coming in, 8 in total, some in areas of need for the Ticats, some maybe less so. Let's start with the first pick, though, Mike, because that's always viewed as the most important, the one that everyone wants to talk about. What do you make of the Ticats going with an offensive lineman out of Laval with their first selection in this year's draft?
Well, me being an offensive line guy, I don't mind it, you know, just because I think you can never have enough depth along the offensive line. That being said, we don't really need offensive linemen right now. I think we're pretty stacked in that category. So I think that maybe if they would have picked, you know, an offensive lineman later on in the draft, I would have been, you know, happier with it. I think there's more need in different positions than the offensive line. But, and also it makes me worry. Every time they pick in the first round, it kind of makes me worry about the draft pick. But, you know, I'm not going to lie and say I know a lot about Dumoulin-Degay or, you know, how good he's going to be. Apparently he posted the fastest 40-yard time for an offensive lineman. But I shouldn't laugh at that, I guess, because I guess back in the day, Brandon Reverberg, you know, was a questionable pick as well. And he's a guy that can move very quick for an offensive lineman. So maybe they looked at this guy and maybe saw some Brandon Reverberg in him. But overall, you know, I like offensive linemen being drafted, but I'm not sure they should have went with their first pick picking an offensive lineman. I think you could have went with a different positional group in this position.
Yeah, that's my thing. I don't know much about this kid. I'll be honest, I think everyone listening to this is aware that we don't know much about any of these guys. We don't really watch a ton of Canadian college football. It's not as readily available as the other football leagues and American college football that we like to watch. They did take all Canadian out of Canadian universities, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. Didn't snag anyone from the NCAA realm. I'm with you in the sense that it's never bad to have too many offensive linemen. But I do question where this kid fits in this year, because you take a kid out of Laval and that's a place where it's not like he's going to go back to school. He's expected. He's already, I believe, in his mid-20s, as most of those Laval kids.
Yeah.
He's 24. So he's an older rookie. They took a offensive line with their first pick last year. I think we agreed that that was probably a good call because they had lost some of their developmental guys over the years. Jesse Gibbon had left. What was the other guy? Khalil, not Khalil Okafor. What was his name? K. Okafor. Khalil Okafor was a basketball player for the 76ers.
A long-term project. Yeah.
And he didn't work out, so they let him go. So I think last year we're thinking, okay, you want to replenish that youth. But you look at what the Ticats are doing with their offensive line this year. And I saw some draft people. I wish I could remember which one, but I read a bunch of stuff. As much as I don't know about these guys, I do try to read what the experts say. But the thing with the experts is they're more often than not wrong than they are right. Because predicting what these kids are going to do once they make the league is incredibly difficult. We see guys across all sports that are viewed as generational talents, elite level prospects that never work out. Like for every LeBron James, there's a Kwame Brown. You know what I mean? So just because you're picked in the first round, just because the people who cover this stuff think that you're going to be great doesn't necessarily mean so. But I saw a bunch of people saying like he can step in today and be the sixth offensive lineman for the Hamilton Tiger Cats. And I guess in the abstract, that's probably correct. However, you look at the makeup of the team, and in my estimation right now, he's no better than the eighth Ticats offensive lineman, because he's not going to replace either of the two tackles because they're Americans, Jordan Murray, Joel Figueroa. Now, obviously, with Figueroa's injury history, things change, but let's work on the assumption everyone stays healthy. He's not replacing any of the interior Canadians that are starting. Woodmansey, David Beard, or Revenberg, who you brought up, those guys are all making big money. They're all established veterans. They've all had loads of starting experience, Revenberg and Beard in particular, Woodmansey less so, but he's been a starter for most of his career with the Ticats. They took a lineman first round last year, Dayton Black. He's still with the team. You expect him to be a step ahead of an incoming rookie because he has a year in the pros. And they signed Evan Johnson, who was, in his own right, a former first-round pick of the Ottawa Redblacks maybe 6 or 8 years ago, went to Saskatchewan, didn't work out. That's where his hometown is. Signs in Hamilton for 1 year. You think you bring in a veteran, you're hoping that he's probably your sixth, maybe your seventh offensive lineman. And now you get to the incoming rookie class. The Ticats, as many people listening to this will remember, last year at times only dressed six offensive linemen. That bit him in the ass a couple of times. They then went to seven. They don't dress eight. So you have a first round pick who, when you look at the pecking order, now things can change in camp, and I understand that, but you look at the pecking order right now, and I don't think anyone who follows this team as closely as you and I do, would put him above any of those seven guys that I just mentioned. So to me, it feels like they went with maybe a projection here of what they can get, but how do you stash a first round pick that you're not dressing? Is he on the one game injured list all year? Does he go on the practice roster worrying that someone else might poach him? I know that that's rare, but it does happen. I didn't even mention Jakob Zott, who's another guy that they signed. I don't necessarily think he's all that good, but he got some time with the team last year, played in some, dressed for some games. When I think of a first round pick, I think of someone who, now in the CFL it is different, but I think of someone who should immediately be a player that's on the game day roster every week. But you look at where the Ticats roster and how it's currently constituted, where's his role? I don't see it. And to me, that makes this pick kind of questionable.
Yeah, I totally agree with everything you're saying. I mean, this is a pick that's going to maybe be playing in 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Like this seems like a developmental pick just because of all the talent we have along the offensive line. Like he's not penetrating the starting lineup unless there's like a slew of injuries. Because like you mentioned, we not only do the five starting players are, you know, set in stone, but the depth guys are pretty much set in stone as well because they have experience in this league. They've proven that they can play. So this kid is coming in and he's a project as far as I'm concerned. He's a guy that might be good down the road. And then when he is good, he might be playing for a different team. So it's hard for me to get excited about this first round pick.
Well, and the thing is, too, is sometimes you think, oh, they'll bring this guy in because in a couple of years, maybe some of these offensive linemen will age out. The Ticats have three offensive linemen on their roster right now that are over the age of 30. It's David Beard, who doesn't look like he's slowing down. It's Joel Figueroa, who's an American and plays a different position. So you kind of don't even add him mm-hmm. to the equation. And it's Revenberg, who, again, doesn't look like he's slowing down anytime soon. Everybody else, you have Dayton Black, 24. You have Evan Johnson, 29. So maybe Evan Johnson's a one-year stopgap, and then this guy takes over for that. But even then, now you're talking about a guy who's coming in as a backup offensive lineman, not starting as a first round pick. Would Manzi, who only has 1 year left on his contract, who signed a 1 year extension this year, but he's only 26. You look at, like, if this would be different if most of Hamilton's offensive linemen were 30 plus, but they're not. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of youth here already. And I get that you want to, you can never have, as you said at the top, you can never have too many Canadian offensive linemen, but this team felt like it had bigger needs, if you ask me. Now, I'm not necessarily sure what those needs might be, but it felt like this, like, I remember going into this draft thinking, I kind of hope they don't take an offensive lineman in the first round. Now, maybe with the way the draft played out, like, maybe they had other guys that they would have liked to have gotten. Like, I'm sure they would have loved the kid that Edmonton selected if he could have fallen, or if they could have moved up to get him, because they have Jordan Williams at linebacker. They could get a backup, a guy that could maybe start. Like, maybe there you have something, but perhaps because of just the way the draft played out, this was the best player available. And if that's the case, so be it. But I just look at that move in correspondence with a kind of a lack of need there. And it makes me question why you would take him. And like you said, like, at what point is this kid going to get into the lineup? And by the time he is he already out the door? We only got him for 3 years. None of these picks have signed, but when you think about it, they will. You only get him for 2 years plus an option. So if he's not starting by midway through year two, are you now wondering, is he even going to be with the team a year and a half from now? So it just felt to me like a questionable move for a team that may have needed to look perhaps defensive line, perhaps in the secondary, maybe even at receiver, more so than they needed to look at the offensive line. All right, what about the other picks, Mike? We have a defensive lineman, two linebackers, two DBs, another O lineman, and a running back. We're not going to discuss the players because we just don't have the capacity to do that. As we've acknowledged, we don't really know much about these guys. But based on the positions they play, do any of these guys stand out to you as possible contributors in 2024, be it offense, defense, or special teams? Or is this kind of looking at a draft class of, because we don't know the guys that much, relative anonymity? But is there anyone that's kind of stood out to you as, oh, maybe this guy could be a player?
Their second pick seemed to have garnered some attention from the Potsky Wee fan base and from the Ticats fan base as a whole. Luke Brabusher, or Brubacher, perhaps, played at Laurier, posted some pretty good numbers, 18 tackles, 6.5 tackles for loss, 6 sacks last year. He's 6'5", 246 pounds. He's a big boy for the defensive lineman. He kind of excites me a little bit just because of his size and how well he played for the Golden Hawks in Canadian university football. He is also expected to attend a minicamp with the National Football League's New York Jets later this month. I'm not sure what that means. You know, a minicamp invite doesn't really mean a ton. You know, I don't think he'll make the team, so he'll probably be in training camp with the Tiger Cats. But the other guys, you know, interest me just because they could be special team players, looking at the positions, defensive back, you know, running back, linebackers, stuff like that. But otherwise, you know, all these players have tremendous attributes and they're going to be 10-year starters in the CFL.
Are you surprised they didn't pick a receiver at all? Because it looks like they're going to roll with two. Looks like it's going to be, at least this year, yeah, Keandre Smith, Luther Hakuna-Vanu. They still have Tyler Tarnowski on a 1-year deal. They brought in Brandon O'Leary Orange, who hasn't really shown all that much offensively speaking. Keandre Smith's in the final year of his contract. Improved tremendously from year one to year two. You expect him to take the leap in year three to even more. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if if he gets the opportunities that he's a 1,000-yard receiver this year. But if that's the case, he's going to get a very large contract next season, maybe ones that the Ticats can't afford. And if that's the case, now you're looking at, wouldn't it have been, now maybe there weren't any receivers that they liked, and that's understandable and perfectly fair comment, but wouldn't it have made sense with the way that they are looking at offensive linemen maybe a year or two down the road? Feels like they should be doing the same thing for the receivers as well. No, like, when you think about where Canadians play in the CFL, especially offensively, it's receiver and its offensive line. They've done a good job of, whether you think the players are any good or not is up to you, but they've done a good job at least giving them options along the offensive line. I don't know if they've necessarily done that at receiver, so I was a little surprised that there wasn't at least one receiver play. Like, I know Peterson plays running back, and I know that the running back from Laval that went in the first round of the Argos is going to convert to receiver in the CFL. I don't think it's the same thing here with Peterson, but it did shock me a little that they didn't at least select one receiver at some point in the draft. What about you?
Yeah, it was a bit surprising considering from what I've heard from the draft experts that this was a pretty, you know, heavy draft when you're considering receivers. You know, there was a lot of good receivers in this draft. So for them not to pick at least one, you know, later on in the draft, at least, is kind of surprising to me, because usually there's at least one receiver that the Ticats pick, right? So to add to the depth would have been probably a smart decision. So yeah, it does surprise me a little bit that there was no receivers picked this year.
All right. Level with me here, Mike. How much of the actual draft did you watch?
I watched up to the 7th pick in the first round just because I wanted to tweet out something about the draft from the Potsky Wee Wee account. So I tweeted out our first round pick, and then after that, I believe I started playing Helldivers. So up to the 7th pick is my answer.
This is a safe space, right? Like, we can be honest here.
Of course.
I didn't watch a single second of it. I don't know if it's because I'm no longer in the media sphere that I just didn't have to pretend like I cared. There was also a tremendous Knicks Sixers game 5 where the Knicks, who are my NBA team, have been a loyal Knicks fan for, Jesus Christ, I can't believe I'm about to say this, 30 some odd years now, going back to the Patrick Ewing, John Starks days when the Bulls were running roughshod over everyone. I, for some stupid reason, chose the Knicks. They were playing a closeout game where they could have won the series. They didn't.
Young.
They ended up winning a
you
couple
were young.
Days. I guess okay. I still should have been smart enough to realize this team that's won 2 championships. I mean, especially when growing up, my favorite player was, like, when I first got into basketball, my favorite player was Magic Johnson. And yet I didn't choose the Lakers. I went with the Knicks. I think it was because, yeah, I mean, if I cheered for the Lakers, I'd have a ton of Lakers championship gear. Mm-hmm. I got none of the Knicks. I haven't won since the 70s, but I think because they were an East Coast team, they were always that early game on the NBA on NBC.
Yep.
So it was always like Knicks Bulls or Knicks Pacers, or especially like going into the later 90s, Knicks Heat. They were always there. So it's like, okay, I like John Starks. Like, that team was fun. They were scrappy. This current iteration of the team actually reminds me a lot of the teams of my youth. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. That was on. I'm always going to put playoff games in over watching a draft. Like, I like the NFL draft. I like the NFL. The Thursday of the NFL draft, the Knicks were playing that night too. I didn't have the NFL draft on. It's easier to follow along with the NFL draft because there's like 17 million people covering it. But I was watching the basketball game instead of the draft and just kind of dipping my toes in and out. I'm not the only one, though, that didn't really pay attention to this stuff. Mike, like you said on one of your recent Patreon shows, you brought out the numbers for combine videos that people were watching. People bitched about the combine, but no one watched the videos on YouTube. The CFL draft is something that they're trying, the media at least, some of which I used to work with, try to make this as if it's like this big event, but it's such a non-factor, it feels like. Like, you look at the NFL draft, the most recent one, 35 million people watched the first night of the draft. Nearly a million people attended it live. It was in Detroit this year, just to kind of watch people walk onto stage. And for the most part, just watch some old dudes walk on the stage and read some names. Why do you think the CFL draft doesn't get that type of hype, that type of coverage? I get it's Canadian. I get it's, I understand all that. Is it a lack of star players? Is it like our problem where it's kind of a lack of knowledge about the incoming players? Is it a lack of like franchise altering players? You watch the NFL draft, you're a Chicago Bears fan. Caleb Williams is your first pick. He's supposed to be this generational quarterback. He could transform the entire history of the franchise. You watch the CFL draft, and the first pick is a linebacker at the University of Cincinnati. Could be a great player. Some have said he's the next Alex Singleton. That'd be awesome. Alex Singleton was a great player, playing great in the NFL. Was Alex Singleton at any time the face of the, let alone the league, but of the Calgary Stampeders? No. So there's something lacking here, right, with the CFL draft. What do you think it is that's missing to make this event feel more important?
Well, first of all, it's, you know, the NCAA football in the States is so massive that these guys that are going into the draft are already well known throughout the country. If you're a football fan, they're already superstars, and they're quarterbacks, they're receivers, they're the sexy positions. And if you draft the right person, it could, like you said, it could alter your franchise for 10 to, if you get that franchise quarterback, it could change the whole dynamic of your franchise. It could change, you know, from being a bottom dweller to being a legit contender. There's not that excitement of these guys.
Ask the Buffalo Bills that question. Bills were terrible for 20 years. They get Josh Allen. Yeah. All of a sudden, they've been a Super Bowl contender the last five. Chiefs with Patrick Mahomes. Didn't win a Super Bowl. The Chiefs didn't win a Super Bowl for 50 years. They've won three of the last five. So, you're right.
Exactly. And the first round of this, you know, first round pick for the Hamilton Tiger Cats is Nathaniel Dumoulin Duguay, an offensive lineman. No offense to him. He may be a great offensive lineman, but he's not altering your franchise for, you know, 10 to 15 years. He's not changing the perception of your franchise. The star power isn't there. You know, the players coming in that's going to make an actual difference right away isn't there. The sexiness isn't there. It's just, the amount of players that are going to turn into something isn't there. You can't even compare the two just because of all the things I just mentioned. Like, I'd love for the draft to get, you know, huge ratings on TSN and everyone to be involved. But the fact of the matter is that these guys aren't going to be, you know, difference makers, like 90% of them. There might be some guys in the rough, you know, some Aston Tonuses that are going to be a great safety or some great offensive linemen. But people aren't interested in great offensive linemen, and they're not really interested in great safeties either. They're interested in great quarterbacking and great receiving and you know, maybe not running back so much because they've been, you know, tarred and feathered that position over the last couple of years. But you know what I'm saying? Like, just to get down to brass tacks, the sexiness isn't there.
The Ticats have whiffed on two first overall picks in the last, six drafts? Jake Burt didn't work out. Mark Chapman never played. Could you imagine? And he was the first overall pick. The Ticats traded up to get him. Think of any other league. I'm not just talking about the NFL. I'm talking any other professional sports league that has a draft. The first overall pick in the draft decides he'd rather stop playing football than play. That would cripple. If that happened in the NFL, if Caleb Williams said, you know what, I'm done playing football, I don't want to play for the Bears, that would cripple them for perhaps a decade. You know what I mean? Ticats drafted Mark Chapman first overall in 2018. They were 15-3 and went to the Grey Cup in 2019. Didn't make a damn bit of difference that they whiffed on that pick. I did some number because I was trying to figure out why I don't care as much anymore. And I tried for like a decade to get into the CFL draft. I really, truly did. And then I looked at some of the numbers. Since 2014, first overall picks that are still with the teams that drafted them. So that's the last 10 drafts. Two. And they're the last. And that's not counting this year's draft. Because we don't know anything about them. But from 2014 to 2023, the number one overall pick that's still with the team that drafted them is two. And it's the last two. Dante Bull, who was the pick for the Red Blacks last year, who barely played and many are already claiming he's a bust. And the other one was, who was the pick in 2022? I completely forgot off the top of my head who it was, but he's the other one that's with him. Jordan Williams was the top pick in 2020. He's now on his third team. Third team, and there was no 2020 season. So 2021, 2022, 4 years. This is his fourth season. He's on his third team. He was the number one overall pick in the draft. Could you imagine in any other league, NHL, NBA, the number one overall pick by year four is on team three? And it's not because he's a bad player. Jordan Williams was rookie of the year. Jordan Williams was really good, BC. He was decent with the Argos. He was acquired by the Ticats to a lot of fanfare. But he's on his third team in 4 years. That's crazy. Don't last, Mike. Like that's the biggest issue is the picks don't stay with the teams that draft them. So therefore, they're not franchise, no matter what player they are. And yes, they're not quarterbacks. And that's the biggest reason, I think. The biggest reason is the lack of quarterbacks. But the one quarterback that was taken in the first round was Trey Ford a couple of years ago. And the Elks have done everything they can to not make him the starting quarterback. And he was probably the most talked about prospect from the 2022 CFL draft. So much so that I can't remember who the first pick in that draft was, but I remember Trey Ford went eighth overall.
So much so that I forget. I'm not going to name him, but he's a university. He follows Canadian University really closely. I think he works for CBC or something. He said that Trey Ford was the best quarterback in the CFL and the NFL draft that year.
I remember that.
Just crazy. But anyways, the other funny thing about the CFL
draft. You know what, though? Pause for a second there. Yeah. You look back on the 2022 NFL draft, the best quarterback out of that draft class was the last pick in the draft, Brock Purdy.
Right.
You look at the top five picks in that draft class. Oh, no, it was the top five quarterbacks the year before. But Kenny Pickett went in that draft. Maybe it's possible that Trey Ford was maybe the second best quarterback prospect in 2022. It's entirely possible, given that Brock Purdy, who was the last pick in the draft, is the best QB out of that class. So maybe he wasn't that far off.
Maybe. But the also funny thing about the CFL draft is that teams avoid the best players in the first round because they're too good, because they might not be seen in the CFL, because they might be in the NFL for their whole careers. So they literally, the best players in the draft might be drafted in the seventh, in the eighth, in the sixth round. So these first round picks are guys that are good, but not too good. You know, not too good that they're going to jump to that other league, right? So that's another funny thing about the CFL draft, that not necessarily the best available players are going to be picked in the very first round.
Well, of all the first round picks of the last 10 drafts, 29 of them are still with the team that drafted him. Only two of those players come previous to 2019. 27 of those 29 were drafted in 2019 or to now. Two of them from 2014 to 2018. Those two are Brandon Reffenberg, who may be the best draft pick the league has had, definitely the top five best draft picks the league has had in the last 10 years. He's been a stalwart almost since day one. I don't think he started from the beginning of his career, but it wasn't long before he took over for Peter Dajkowski, and Peter Dajkowski was gone. At the end of that season, he was traded to Saskatchewan. And the other one's Ryan Hunter. Ryan Hunter was drafted in the first round 2018. But the thing with Ryan Hunter is he didn't come to the CFL until midway through the 2022 season. So the Argos took a chance on him in 2018, and it took over 4 years for him to finally make the CFL. So maybe he wouldn't still be with the Argos if he had started in 2018. Maybe he had moved on somewhere else. That to me is, with all the other stuff, I mentioned the sexiness of the picks, the quarterbacks, the receivers, the guys that, like you just said, they're not the super superstars. They're not the top guys. They're not your John Mechie's the third, who was probably the top ranked player in 2022. But because he was a second round pick in the NFL, there was no chance he was coming up to the CFL. So team's not going to waste a first round pick on him. It's the lack of these guys staying. I think it's simply the lack of the guys. Why am I going to get invested in this first round pick if I know in 3 years, maybe he decides I'd rather play close to home and he's buggering off to Montreal? How many guys have we seen over the years that get drafted by a team are really good? Think of Brendan Labatt. Think of Andy Fantuz. I mean, even if he wasn't that good, think of how many guys want to go back to, like Evan Johnson, want to go back to Saskatchewan, want to go back to Winnipeg, want to come back to Ontario. I mean, Jordan Williams was a great player for the BC Lions, wanted to be closer to the East Coast, so they had to trade him to Toronto. There's so many more factors, I think, outside of whether these players are good and why they stick, that also hurts. Like, could you imagine being a BC Lions fan? You're like, oh man, we got this great linebacker. He started 2 years for us. Wait, he wants to leave because why? That would never happen in another pro sports league. Yes, guys leave, like John Tavares leaves the New York Islanders, but he was with the New York Islanders to come to Toronto. What was he there, like 7 years? Like I'm not saying you have to sign them to 8-year contracts extension, and I think that's ridiculous, but if there is a way for guys to stay longer, I think there might be more interest in this because you know you're going to get this guy for 5, 6, 7 years versus maybe 3. You get him for, and then they – you develop them, they turn into these good players, and then they bugger off because they want to play closer to home. don't fault them for it. Don't get me wrong. But how am I supposed to get excited by these picks if I know he's just going to leave and go somewhere else because by the time he hits his prime, he's off playing somewhere else. It's hard to get invested in guys like that.
I agree. And in the CFL, it's more, it means more to these guys to play at home because they're not going to get that, you know, difference in money if they're playing in Saskatchewan, right? Like, it's not going to be that much more. It might be like $10,000, $5,000 more, but it's not going to be life altering money for them to be like, okay, this is worth it for me to be away from my family because I'm going to make so much money that it's going to change my life in the future. So these guys love to come back home and play in their, you know, in their own provinces because the money just isn't that much different from team to team.
All right. I think we've kind of wrung the draft discussion dry. Let's talk about some of the big news. That's really all the Ticats news we have this week, too. And there's a little bit later that we're going to get into. We're going to have a little fun with. But let's talk about some of the bigger CFL stories of the past week. Probably the biggest one that's come out since we last sat down and recorded was that Sean Lemon, who recently retired rather abruptly, I think we all kind of took us by surprise, has been indefinitely suspended by the league for gambling on CFL games going back to the 2021 season when he was with the Calgary Stampeders. I think now that this has come out, we kind of go, oh, you kind of put two and two together, right? He signed an extension with the Owls last year after they won the Grey Cup. And then before the season starts, decides, I don't want to play anymore. And now then this came out a couple weeks after that. You're like, oh, okay. It's kind of making sense. But Lemon was a great player. I don't think there's any denying that. He's one of the few guys who has 100 career sacks in the CFL. He was 35, so he is a little bit older, but he signed an extension. He wanted to play. This comes out, a lot of talk about it. What do you think of this, Mike? Like, Sean Lemon had a great career, multi-time Grey Cup champion, 100 sacks. Do you think that this suspension here will impact his Hall of Fame candidacy? And maybe the bigger question is, should it?
I think it might. You know, I don't think this individual case is that outrageous, and I don't think he should be punished in that way necessarily. I think he made a bet on his team, the Calgary Stampeders, to win. And I'm, you know, in football, it's harder to, you know, sway a game in the way that you want it to go if this is what you're doing, right? It may be different in basketball because there's less players and you can involve yourself in the game more and you can, you know, point spreads and all that stuff. But it's harder for like a defensive lineman to affect the game in that way. So I think it should be taken seriously, obviously, because we don't want the integrity of the game to be, you know, questioned or anything like that. But on this individual case, I'm not sure it's a huge deal, but we don't want this like widespread. And I brought this up on my show this week. I think it might've been feedback. I can't remember, but, you know, is it more prevalent in leagues like this in the CFL where players aren't getting paid life-changing salaries, you know, where it might be more of an option for these guys because they don't make as much money? Do you believe that to be the case? Like, do you think it's more likely that a league like the CFL would have players betting on their games because they're making $100,000 compared to, you know, $50 million in the NBA if you're a top-end player? Do you think that's more likely in a league like the CFL?
I understand that line of thinking. I'm not sure. Like, it makes sense from like a, oh, well, why would I harm making $250 million as an NFL quarterback by placing a parlay on a thing? But like Calvin Ridley was a superstar receiver for the Atlanta Falcons, was due for a big contract extension with the Falcons, got suspended a year because he bet like $1,500 on a couple of NFL games. Like, it wasn't even a lot of money. Now, he eventually came back, played for Jacksonville last year, signed a big contract with the Tennessee Titans, so it didn't hurt him in any way. We saw a bunch of NFL guys in the last couple of years get suspended for this. Obviously, the biggest case is the Jonte Porter one with the Raptors, but that was he was funneling information to his friends who were betting on his props. He was jacking up threes to miss them and then exiting the game claiming he was hurt. Like, that's, I think, a little bit different than what Lemon did, where he placed a bet or maybe multiple bets on his team to win. Or now I understand why sports books and why leagues have that, because sports books don't want players gambling because they have insider information. they don't want guys gambling on like prop bets because it's like, well, they know, oh man, they know that Jake Mayer, like Sean Lemon's playing for the Stamps. He knows Bo Levi Mitchell in 2021's got a bum shoulder. Well, he's not throwing for 350 yards today, so I'm going to pick the under. Like, I get why they don't want it. I have very little sympathy for sports books, granted, because they take advantage of people, but I like to gamble. You like to gamble. I'm not here to pontificate, morally philosophize on gambling, but I understand from there. I also understand from the league's perspective, you don't want the integrity of the game to be impacted. To your question, I don't know. I think guys just, it's the thrill of the win. Like, I mean, Charles Barkley made how much money playing in the NBA, and he talks about all, he gambles all the time. Jordan, Floyd Mayweather made how much money in boxing, gambled all the time, and loses. Like, yeah. These guys lose money, but it's the thrill of.
Michael Jordan's the obvious, you know, he was famous for how he loved to gamble. So, yeah,
there's, it's the rush. There's still a conspiracy theory to this day that Michael Jordan's retirement following the 93 NBA Finals was a shadow suspension because he was caught gambling. Like, so
yeah.
Now, whether you believe that or not, I don't necessarily believe that to be the case because he was talking about retirement. If you go back and watch the footage, he was talking about retirement. His father was murdered. There was a lot going on. Yes. But that's still a conspiracy that lives to this day because of that's what these guys did. So there's that thrill there. My thing is, and I used to work with him. I have a lot of respect for the guy. But on this, he's dead wrong. J.C. Abbott, Three Down Nation, said, gambling on games is worse than taking performance-enhancing drugs, and I can't think of a dumber sentence that I've ever heard a human being say. You're telling me that the integrity of the game is more at risk with Sean Lemon betting on the Calgary Stampeders to win than it is from a player like Andrew Harris taking banned substances. Because here's the thing. When this news came out, maybe a day later, Andrew Harris, the thing was he's signing a one-day contract with the Bombers. He's going to retire a Bomber, and everyone's like, he's a shoo-in for the Hall of Fame. How is what he did? Now, he only tested positive once, but Sean Lemon only got caught gambling once. But the thing is, if you got caught once, how many times were you actually doing it and just got lucky? How is it that someone is considered a shoo-in for the Hall of Fame when they used substances to enhance their ability to play the game at an advanced age when most players are likely to do that? And how is that not more a detriment to the integrity of the game versus a guy wagering? Like, Sean Lemon's indefinitely suspended. Now, even if he wasn't 35 and likely not to come back anyway, this could be a lifetime ban. But yet you can take PEDs and two-game suspension, you're back on the field. What's more detrimental to the integrity of a sport than someone using a substance to enhance their performance to better themselves on the field? Or is it a guy placing a $100 wager on the Stamps to cover the spread? One's worse than the other, and it's not the one that's getting the guy suspended for an indefinite amount of time.
No, yeah, exactly. And it's like in this case, like if you're going case by case, it's obvious that Andrew Harris is the worst offender in my eyes, because Sean Lemon made one bet worth, you know, according to Farhanology, it was like around $80 or something like that for his team to win. So he wasn't, you know, ruining the integrity of the game or anything like that with that bet. He wanted to win because he was on the Calgary Stampeders, and he played hard to win because he made a bet on it. Now, I'm not saying it's right, but it's not comparable to Andrew Harris taking PEDs. It's just not.
No. And to answer the question, answer my own question I asked, I don't think this should impact his Hall of Fame candidacy at all. I really don't. I think it might, because we look at Pete Rose. Pete Rose gambled on baseball. He was banned from MLB, can't be in the Hall of Fame. He's the all-time hits leader. But I think everyone now looks at that and goes, that's not worthy.
That's
of.
Dumb.
It is. I mean, I saw some recently. There's a statue of Pete Rose in Cincinnati outside the Red Stadium. Directly across the street is an MGM sports book. Mm-hmm. We have become but it's like with everything. And I'm okay with it that we're allowing adults to be adults. You want to gamble? Gamble. You take it too far, you're hurting yourself. Like, yes, I understand addiction and all that stuff. You want to smoke weed? Smoke weed. I know that like these things can hurt, but tobacco can hurt people. Alcohol abuse has probably caused more damage to society than marijuana, than probably most drugs and gambling combined, if we're being honest. But booze is legal, so we talk about, oh, we're going to go get shit-faced on the weekend, and oh, man, I'm going to the game. I'm going to have 10 beers. But if I said to someone, oh man, you know what? I just wagered $1,000 on a game. They say, are you out of your goddamn mind? But if I spend $1,000 on alcohol at a football game, no one bats an eye. Well, maybe $1,000 would be a bit much. But you know what I mean? Like, you go out there and you're buying 10 of those $12 beers, people don't care. But if I put $100 on the game, people are like, well, that's kind of a waste of money.
I have to watch these gambling commercials. I have to watch these gambling commercials, you know, and they've watched like beer commercials for 30 years, you know. Drink some beer, you'll feel good. You know, it's all good. It's just like social norms, you know. It's funny how that works out.
Well, if gambling was legal in the 70s and you've been dealing with it up until now, like, you know what I mean? Like, people wouldn't bat an eye at it. But it was evil and it was bad. And it was, and the leagues are embracing it. And I think there's the hypocrisy of that when it comes to this as well. Like, people are like, well, the leagues embrace this stuff. What do you expect? And it's like, I get why people, it's like, you work for a business. Maybe this is a better analogy. You have insider information on a stock tip. You can't then use that to help other, you know what I mean? Like, to give that to someone else to profit from it. It's against the law. I'm fine with leagues saying we're in bed with gambling. We wanted a part of the thing, but the players can't do it. I don't see the hypocrisy there. I really truly don't, because I think there needs to be a delineation between the players and the members of the team and the members of the league and whatever they do to promote. Like, I mean, at one point we had beer commercials. At one point we had cigarette ads at games. So would you be okay then if a guy's, I mean, actually, you know what? They are okay with that. John Gott's fucking TD celebration. He's cracking beers like Stone Cold Steve Austin. Everyone thought it was the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah.
But he was drinking beers during a game. And then people got mad when the league was like, you're not allowed to do that anymore. And it's like, oh, come on. That's so fun. It's like, well, what if a guy came off the field and said, I just made myself an extra $500. I bet on my anytime TD prop bet. People be up in arms because they don't agree with gambling as a vice. They're okay with alcohol. They're not okay with gambling. But I just think that this should impact what he did on the field. There are certain things that I think players do that should impact their, I think performance enhancing drugs is one of those things. If you're caught doing it, I think that should be a major detriment, and it won't. Andrew Harris is going to get in the Hall of Fame. He's probably going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer, and everyone's going to gloss over the fact that this happened because it was a one-time transgression. Mm-hmm. But Sean Lemon's one-time transgression, which maybe it isn't. Maybe, you know, he got caught once. Like I said, maybe he's doing this all the time. He just got caught one time. This to me is nowhere. It's not even in the same ballpark as doing drugs. And I think Sean Lemon's career on the field should decide whether or not he's in the Hall of Fame or not. Not whether or not he put, as you said, $80 in the stamps to win a game 3 years ago.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just going to, my final statement on this is, I understand why the league did what they did, because you have to protect the integrity of the league. But with Sean Lemon as an individual going forward, like, you know, whenever he's considered in the Hall of Fame 10, 15 years from now, this should be looked back on and been like, okay, we caught him once. We only have proof for this one time. He didn't bet against his team. I think he should still be considered for the Hall of Fame just because of this. I don't think that should be taken away from him because he put an $80 bet on his team to win. So I think it should be taken seriously, but I don't think he should be punished forever for this mistake.
All right. Speaking of the Hall of Fame, the league announced the 2024 class this past week. Weston Dressler, SJ Green, Chad Owens, Marvin Coleman, Vince Goldsmith, Ray Jock, maybe, I'm not sure how to pronounce the name, and Ed Laverty are your inductees. Obviously the big three are Dressler, Green, and Owens. We saw their entire careers. Dressler was the 2008 most outstanding rookie, played 11 seasons with the Riders and the Bombers, two-time league all-star, four-time division all-star, obviously won the Grey Cup with the Riders. SJ Green was a tremendous, tremendous player for the Alouettes and the Argos, 8 times division all-star, 2-time CFL all-star, 3-time Grey Cup champion. Chad Owens, who I'll admit, I was at first when I saw, I was like, him? Really? But then you look at his credentials, MOP in 2012, 2010 and 2011 most outstanding special teams player. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, 2012, Chris. Oh, yeah, I was like, no, Chris Williams won 2011. No, Chris Williams won 2012. 5-time division all-star, 4-time CFL all-star, 1-time Grey Cup champ. Coleman played for the Stamps and the Bombers. Actually, if the thing I remember, because I don't really remember Marvin Coleman's career, But if you go back, this is going to be really nerdy. If you go back and watch the Canadian Stampede pay-per-view from 97, you know the one I'm talking about, right? That big 10-man tag with the Hart Foundation against all the American guys. Yep. You go back and watch that show. It's a great, one of the best cards that the WWF ever put together. There's a dude in the crowd in a Marvin Coleman jersey. I remember I was watching it one time years ago, and I was like, is that a Stamps jersey? I was trying to look at it, like, whose number is that? So I looked up the 97 Stamps, because I don't think I ever saw the back, but I looked up the 97 Stamps roster, and it came up. I was like, oh, that's kind of neat that he's there. So pretty darn good Hall of Fame class. I think the three that, were, like I said, the ones we're most familiar with are obviously the three big receivers. What are your thoughts on this Hall of Fame class? As I said, I was a little surprised that Chad Owens got in until I looked at that resume, but now I look at it, and I was like, oh, no, it's pretty damn deserving. What about you? You like this class here?
Yeah, I like it a lot. I was just surprised that you know, it just seemed like so quick for Chad Owens and Weston Dressler to be inducted. And my only thought was maybe there might be some other guys that haven't been inducted yet that deserve to be in this class, but I don't have any names for you, so you know, that's kind of a moot point on my part. But I was surprised. Yeah, Robbie. Yeah, there you go.
That's the name that could have been. His continued snubbing of the Hall of Fame is infuriating to me.
Mm-hmm. It will be the death of us. But, I mean, I was the same with you. I was like, okay, Chad Owens. And I read, you know, his career accolades. And yeah, he's deserving. I think all these guys are deserving. My only question was, were they inducted too quickly? But overall, you know, they should be in the Hall of Fame. And well-deserving, all of these guys. So, you know, with Marvin Coleman, he was a great DB, but he was also a very good returner as well. He sits fourth all-time with 5,211 punt return yards. So the guy did it not only in the secondary, but also kick returning. So a hell of a player. All these guys are well-deserved, and my hat goes off to them.
It certainly makes me feel old, I'll be honest with you, because it feels as if – now, here's the thing. So maybe this is the 90s kid in me, but Weston Dressler was the 2008 Most Outstanding Rookie. In my head, maybe that was 5-6 years ago, not 16 years ago. Yeah. 2008 was 16 years ago?
Yeah.
Like that just – like, what? SJ Green, like in my head, oh, we just got off that game where we beat the Ticats beat the Owls in the East Final. And the only good thing for the Owls in that game was SJ Green absolutely torched Brandon Stewart for three touchdowns. That was a decade ago. How was that a decade ago? Like that's like Chad Owens was a superstar when Iverwind Stadium was still alive and where we watched games. Like, to me, it's just these guys feel too modern to be in, and it's nothing against them. Like, I think they all, and maybe that's where, like you said, it feels too soon. Maybe that's what it feels like too. Like, it feels like these guys just stopped playing. Yeah. Like, it feels like they're, but it's like Weston Dressler's probably been out of the league maybe a half dozen years. Like, did he, I don't think he played post pandemic. Like, I don't think any of these guys played post pandemic.
No.
So it's like, okay, well, the pandemic was 4 years ago. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it just feels as if these guys are still capable of being in their primes, not someone who was the top rookie. Like, I mean, SJ Green won a Grey Cup, won two Grey Cups with Anthony Calvillo in Montreal. Anthony Calvillo's been out of the league 11 years. Like, that's the thing that warps my brain. The other thing about this is, and this is no slight on Chad Owens, because as I said, initially I thought Hall of Famer. Looking at it now, no, definitely. I think Brandon Banks is now shoo-in for the Hall of Fame. I mean, Brandon Banks won an MOP. Brandon Banks, multi-time All-Star. Brandon Banks, one Most Outstanding Special Teams player. I think he won it. Did he win twice? Did he win 2015 and 2016? He might have. He definitely won it once. But he's an MOP. And he won a Grey Cup. Like, he's got, like, so if, and Chad Owens was the same. Returner, who then became a really good receiver. He was kind of both at the same time. Banks was a great returner and then a great receiver. I would have thought Speedy's Hall of Fame case was debatable, but with Chad Owens getting in, I know we don't like to talk about him much because he's kind of a dick, but Brandon Banks is going to go to the Hall of Fame. I don't think there's any question of it now.
Yeah, if Chad Owens is in, then Brandon Banks is. Those careers are very comparable, and I think Brandon Banks is just slightly above him. When we're talking about overall play, you know, I just don't remember Chad Owens. Chad Owens was a really good return man, but he wasn't Brandon Banks. He didn't have the impact of Brandon Banks in big games returning the ball as well. So, yeah, Chad Owens is in. Brandon Banks will be in eventually as well.
All right, let's talk about Nathan Rourke, Mike, because his future with the New England Patriots and maybe his future in the NFL is a little up in the air after the Patriots selected North Carolina quarterback Drake May with the third overall pick in the most recent NFL draft. If that wasn't enough, New England also selected Tennessee quarterback Joe Milton in the sixth round, as well as signing free agent quarterback Jacoby Brissett in March, while also still having 2022 fourth round pick Bailey Zappe on the roster. So that puts Rourke at best, in my opinion, as the number three quarterback behind May and Brissett. But more than likely, that puts him in the number five spot behind all those guys. That puts his chances of making the team, I don't want to say 0% chance, but it's down there that he's going to be a Patriot this year, even as a practice roster player. And we saw last year that Rourke failed to make the Jacksonville Jaguars roster, but pardon me, hung around most of the year on their practice roster. I'm sure that Rourke will get a chance like he did with Jacksonville last year in the preseason to kind of show his stuff with the Patriots, but it's starting to feel like those NFL chances that we were all so wowed by are kind of drying up for him, Mike. So with all this new information, with what the Patriots have done and where he kind of stands in the pecking order, do you think we see Nathan Rourke return to the CFL this season, or do you think his return is more likely for 2025 than kind of midway through 2024?
Yeah, I don't really see it this year. I think you're absolutely right that the prospects of him being on the starting roster for the New England Patriots are pretty slim as of right now, just because of who they drafted and, you know, who's ahead of him on the depth chart. But I do think he'll hang around in the NFL. Maybe someone else will pick him up and he'll be a third, or he'll be on another practice roster or something. I don't see him coming back to the league this year, and maybe not even next year. But the way that it's going for him, I'm just not sure he's going to get a legit shot at, you know, being even a backup, even being a second QB on a roster, because I just don't know that, you know. And he was available last year. Like, people could have claimed him off waivers, and everyone passed until the Patriots picked him up, I believe. So, yep. And maybe we overvalued, like, the people in this country, maybe we overvaluated his talent. We know that he's a hell of a quarterback in the CFL, but, you know, and maybe he could be a hell of a quarterback in the NFL, but maybe these teams just don't look at him in that way. You know what I mean? He was a guy that played in the MAC in university, and that's not exactly a hotbed for NFL quarterbacks. And you know, quarterbacks going from the CFL to the NFL, that's not exactly a hotbed of you know, opportunities over the years either. I mean, when was the last time you saw a CFL player jump from the CFL to the NFL and be a starting quarterback? Is probably like Jeff Garcia. So that's been...
It might have been Jeff Garcia.
Yep. And that's, you know, we're talking about the late 90s now. So it's been a very long time. And I don't think he's going to get that opportunity. I don't think he is. And you can only sit on a practice roster for so long. So I don't think it's going to be this year that he's back in the CFL, and maybe not even in 2025. But after that, I think eventually he's going to want to play. He's going to want to be a starting quarterback again, I think. And he can make really good money up here. Like, not obviously.
He'd be the highest paid player in the league when he comes back.
No doubt about it. All nine teams will be lined up, you know, chomping at the bit to get this guy signed. So, like I said, I don't think he's going to be this year. I'm not sure it's going to be next year. But I think eventually he will be in the CFL as a starting quarterback.
So you're thinking it's more likely 2026 that he comes back then, eh?
Yeah, I just think that, you know, and maybe the opportunity won't be there, but I think if there's any opportunity at all, he will hang on for as long as possible in the NFL. He's like, you know, that's his dream. So I don't blame him for it. But I think eventually, maybe a year or two, the opportunities will dry out and he will come back to the CFL.
All right, so let's play a fun game here then. I'm with you. I don't think he comes back this year. I do think 2025 is a possibility, because let's say he's released by the Patriots this August/September when the training camp's over, preseason's over, season's about to start, and no one picks him up, I think 2025 is a realistic possibility. But I do think he holds on for the rest of this season to try to find a home. Like maybe a guy gets hurt, mm-hmm. maybe a team eventually brings him in. But I do think 2025 is the possibility for his return. So let's have something fun here. Let's say he does return either this year, more likely next. Let's say next is more likely. You said all nine teams would be lining up to sign him. I'm not sure BC would be, just because they did give Vernon Adams a big contract extension. Now, we do know that those deals are not worth the paper they're written on. Teams can get out of them rather easily. But I think BC seems pretty happy with VA, but that's where Rourke is from, so you can never discount it, right? What would be your top three destinations? Let's work on the 2025 timeline so you can kind of wrap your head around maybe where the teams would be quarterback-wise at the time. What do you think are the three most likely landing spots for Nathan Rourke should he return to the CFL for the 2025 season?
Well, I think Toronto would be in the mix no matter what. I think they'll throw a ton of money at him like they tried to do with Bo Levi Mitchell, you know, four or five seasons ago with that $800,000 rumor. I think they'll be throwing a ton of cash at him. But also, I think Hamilton would be a legit option. I mean, he's from, I don't know, he grew up somewhere. Oakville, yeah. So that's obviously close in
right
the area.
Right smack dab in the middle between Toronto
yes.
and Hamilton.
Yes. So, and I think that obviously Bo Levi Mitchell being 34 years old, a couple more seasons, you know, I think they would trade up, obviously, to try to get Nathan Rourke, and that would make a lot of sense. He would play in front of a fan base that really cares about his team. I'm already lobbying for him to come to the Hamilton Tiger Cats, but I think it would be Toronto, Hamilton, and maybe a team like Edmonton or Calgary, for that matter. I mean, like Edmonton, the quarterback situation, you brought in Bethel Thompson. Yes, you have Trey Ford. Bethel Thompson, I don't know how that's going to work out. He's aging as well. I could see Edmonton going after him hard. And then like a team like Calgary, like we don't know. And I know that's four teams, but we don't know with Jake Mayer. Is he going to turn out to be anything? So I could see the two Alberta teams also throwing a ton of money and being heavily involved in trying to court Nathan Rourke.
You want my conspiracy theory with Toronto, but it has mm-hmm. to do with this season.
Okay.
It works next season, but it could have to do with this season. My conspiracy theory is, this whole Chad Kelly situation resolves itself and he's guilty and he gets turfed from the league. The Argos are terrible this year and it's all to give Nathan Rourke the job in 2025. They offer him yep. the largest contract yep. anyone's been offered in the cap era, more than even Bo Levi was offered by them, for him to be the quarterback there. Because as an Oakville kid, Ontario ties, Canadian, as much as there's no real marketable stars, Rourke as the backup option, should the reigning MOP be hopefully rightfully turfed from the league if these things come out to be true. I mean, can you think of a more Argos thing than them fucking Cosmo Kramering their way into, well, we lost our star quarterback. Oh, well, we fell ass backwards into the greatest Canadian quarterback right. this league has ever seen. Of course, that's how it would happen. I now. Think Hamilton is a legitimate destination too, though. Yep. Okay, you want to say yep. something about the Argos conspiracy theory?
I wonder if Nathan Rourke would consider signing with the Argonauts since he publicly kind of shamed them with.
That's a good point. I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
Think
so, that. So maybe Toronto might, even if they throw like $1 million at him, let's say, would he sign with them based on, you know, his feelings around the franchise and how they've handled their current quarterback situation? It's an interesting question.
I hadn't thought of that. I really like that. Okay, that moves me on to what I was about to say. I do think Hamilton's legitimate. I mean, anytime a big-time quarterback comes up, no matter where it is, Hamilton's mm-hmm. always in the mix. Bo's going to be, what, 34, 35 at the start of the 2025 season? Like, he wasn't great last year. If he has another subpar year this year, he's probably not on the team anyway. Could you imagine a better upgrade than going and snagging Nathan Rourke?
No.
Now, I'm with you on Calgary and Edmonton. McCall Bustle Thompson's only got 1 year left on his. Like, he only signed a 1 year deal, so they don't seem to want to give it to Trey Ford. Trey Ford will be a free agent after the season anyway, so that makes a lot of sense.
Stampeders, Calgary maybe picked, not, because they don't like to spend a ton of money. I'm thinking about it. But yeah. It's a special situation, right?
Yeah. Calgary makes sense because Mayer's in the last year of his contract, and if he's no good. What about this as a you want to extend the window? Winnipeg does the gutsy thing, releases Zach Caleros because he'll be, we're working on the 2025 timeline here. He'll be 37 during that season. They decide, you know what? We want, yes, this group is aging, but we do have some younger players. They still have Brady Oliveira. Like, the receivers aren't, they still have Dalton Schoen. They want to extend this window. They let Zach Caleros go. They release him to sign Nathan Rourke. What about that as like, again, these are, all of this is speculation and fun, but I was just, because I was looking at the teams and in my head, it was like, oh, Hamilton makes sense. Toronto makes sense with if they don't have Chad Kelly. Oh, Saskatchewan, like the Edmonton's Calgary, Saskatchewan could make sense if they let Trevor Harris go. Ottawa didn't, like Drew Brown's there, so that makes them a little less likely, you know what I mean? But if he flames out, obviously they'll be in the mix. And even if he doesn't, they'll probably still be in the mix. BC was really the only one, but even then, like you said, all nine teams would be interested in this guy. Mm-hmm. But Winnipeg at doing the, it's very rare to see, like, it's like if Winnipeg goes to the cup again, and let's say they lose for a third straight year, but they get back the five straight trips to the Grey Cup, even with three losses, still an incredible run. What if they're in their heads are like, we've gone as far as this group can take us. It's time to maybe usher in the next group. And what better way to do that than by taking perhaps the best quarterback who would come back in, maybe be the best. I mean, 2022, but if he doesn't get hurt, he's probably winning MOP that year. So what, like, that would, it would take a lot of balls. It would take a ton of balls, but would any fan base be more amenable to their team moving on from their franchise quarterback that took them the two Grey Cups, that won two MOPs, more than Winnipeg? Because you have that group has built up so much goodwill in that community that even if they do something like this, they'd have to give them the benefit of the doubt it's going to work out, right?
Yeah. And I just think that it's an opportunity that you can't pass up. Even if you have a guy like Zach Caleros, who has done so many great things for that franchise, you know, you got to think that it's coming to an end for him, and you got to look forward with your franchise. And you cannot, if the opportunity's there and he wants to sign with your team, you have to make that decision to let Caleros go and bring in Rourke, because that could be an extension and maybe even a more successful period of time on the field and off the field. I mean, what, they made like $5 million last year. Year, this team is flush with cash right now. I'm sure they wouldn't be afraid to go over the cap by a little bit to bring in Nathan Rourke, considering all the money that they're making with all the sellouts that they had last year, and you know, all the momentum that's going forward for them. I think it'd absolutely be worth it to let Zach go and bring in the new guy, because you know he's going to be, you know, a very, very, very good starting quarterback, and he's a Canadian. So, I mean, you just can't pass on that opportunity if it presents itself.
Yeah, I think the one snag is wondering if they would be willing to do it, and two, if the lure of playing in Ontario would be too much. And if that's the case, yep, I think we're in the running there. All right. Yeah. Speaking of going over the cap, Mike, we're going to get out of here in this one. It's been a bit of a long episode, but we had a lot to talk about today. The league announced that the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, BC Lions, and our Hamilton Tiger Cats all exceeded the CFL salary cap in 2023. The Bombers went over by around 26,000, the Lions by 86 or so, and the Ticats by $2,600. Yes, $2,600. For most people out there listening to you, that is a month of salary. That is what the Ticats went over for the 2023 season. The punishment for being over by less than $100,000 is a dollar-for-dollar fine, so all these teams are paying the equivalent of what they went over. But, Mike, this is obviously not enough for these dirty, dirty cheaters, right? Like, given that these teams clearly had no regard for the rules, they disregarded everything completely, what should be their punishment? Expulsion from the league, forced to forfeit games. I mean, Mike, we talked about the integrity of the game earlier. The integrity of this game is at stake here. What kind of advantage did the Ticats get for that extra $2,600 in player salary? You know what I mean? Like,
oh my God,
they must have used that to help them go 8-10 instead of 7-11. But in all seriousness, right, do you care about this at all? Like, in fact, don't you think more teams should be willing to do this? Like, is this something that really bothers you?
No, I think all the teams should be relegated to the UFL. a little shot in there. It doesn't bother me. it's not, you know, it's a soft cap, right? These, you know, you can go over by a little bit, you know, and then the most egregious offender this year went over by $86,000, and maybe you could get, you know, a decent player for that. But like, to me, teams should spend how much they want to spend. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to go over by 100,000, go over by 100,000. If you want to go over by 500,000. That's your decision to make. How badly do you want to win, right? I mean, most of these, like, there's been a lot of teams going over the cap in the history of this league, and usually it's never an amount that, you know, is eye-opening or you're going to make you gasp. It's always under $100,000 usually. So these things don't bother me. And, you know, I think that if teams want to win, you know, they should go over the cap. That's just how I feel.
I think it's pretty obvious where I land on this. I remember back in the day when I was first understanding, because when the CFL introduced the salary cap, it was like, what, 2007, 2008, something like that. I think the only team that's ever gone over and forfeited a draft pick, I think, was Montreal. I could be wrong, but I think that happened like early on in this, like maybe 09, like some when they were really in their heyday. I think there might have been a year where they went over by over 100 grand and had to forfeit a pick. But I think it's like when I didn't understand the cap when it first was implemented, because in my head, you think of football, you think of, well, you can't go over the cap in the NFL. You know what I mean? In the NHL, they introduced the cap. You can't go over the cap in the NHL. Baseball and basketball is different, but I had my football thing on. It's like, oh, the cap in the NFL is whatever it is. I think now it's like $260 million or something. And it's like, okay, well, that's how much teams can spend and they're not allowed to go over that. And that's the way it works. But even that's not correct, because there's carryover numbers. And the more you learn about these things, the more you realize that teams can maneuver the cap in ways. The CFL is a little more standard, but when I first started, it's like, oh, the Riders went over to win the Grey Cup in 2013. That's bullshit. But then it's like, well, no, it's maybe if the Ticats had gone over a few of those years, maybe we wouldn't have a 25-year Grey Cup drought. Now, you can't just say, like, you go over, you win, because the three teams that went over this year, none of them won the Grey Cup, so it didn't really make a difference. But, yeah, I think, obviously, having grown, having understanding this, this to me is not a big deal. And anyone making a big deal of it, I think, is either a troll or just someone who doesn't understand how it works either. That's fine. But I have seen some comments from people that said, and you kind of touched on this already, the first 100,000 is fine if teams want to go over that. But if you go over that, which causes that loss of draft pick, then you've gone a bit too far. Given what the first half of this episode was, where we talked about kind of the relative lack of importance of the draft, I'm not saying it's not important, but given, especially with the Ticats, but with most teams, the inability to even retain those draft picks, would you even care if a team, like, let's say the Ticats gave up a pick, like you said, go $500,000 over. Nathan Rourke's available, and the Ticats got to go over the cap to bring him in to the detriment of their draft class. Do you care? If it helps them to win a Grey Cup, I don't give a crap if they don't have a draft pick next year. Like, they're probably going to waste it on an offensive line that's never going to play anyway.
Yeah, I wouldn't care. I think that other teams' fans would care, but I don't really care what they think. Yeah. So the only way I would care is, like, if a team, say, went egregiously over, like, say some team went, like, spent $20 million or something crazy, then it'd be like, okay, that's a bit of an advantage on their part, but, like, that never happens. So to me, $100,000 of the cap, 500, like, whatever, as long as you're not going over by, like, $5 million, then I don't really give a crap.
I've said this in the last maybe 18 or so months, that, and obviously this was before all the stuff where they became actual villains because of the shit they're doing behind the scenes, but I always thought if the Argos wanted to be relevant, they would do something like that. They would, the CFL salary cap is 5. What million? Well, we're spending 10, and we're spending 10 million, and we're bringing in all the star players, and we are going to be the New York Yankees of the Canadian Football League. Yeah. And we are going
to,
for
a while too, actually.
Yeah. And given the fact that they're owned by a billion-dollar corporation that we've said for the longest time, the Argos, and everyone says this, the losses the Argos suffer financially are a footnote in MLSE's ledger. Let them spend, bring in all the best players, and then they become the big, bad New York Yankees. They become the team that everyone wants to beat.
Yep.
And then and maybe they do win 6 Grey Cups in a 12-year span, or they win 4 Grey Cups in a 6-year, like, maybe they become so good, but I do think that villains, for on-field purposes, are good for the sport, are good for sports in general. Teams rooting against teams. Like, I don't really watch hockey, but back when I did watch hockey, I hated the Boston Bruins. I hate all Boston sports teams, quite frankly, mostly because that city has been incredibly successful over the last 20 years. The Patriots have won 6 Super Bowls. The Celtics and the Bruins have won championships. The Red Sox have won, I think, 3 World Series. Like, there are kids there that have been to more, in a 10-year span, there are kids there that went to more parades than I've seen teams win championship. Fuck, probably since I've seen teams make playoffs, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. But So they were playing this week. I don't have any interest in, I don't watch hockey anymore. And I know people hate the Leafs for a lot of the same reasons that I hate the Bruins, but I really would have liked to see the Bruins get knocked off. I really want to see the Celtics get knocked off. Like, I think, like, I tuned into, like, I watched that game seven last night because we're recording this on Sunday morning. I watched that game seven, that Leafs Bruins game, and I've probably watched, I watched a lot of Leafs games at the end of the year because I was kind of invested in that will Matthews score 70 goals thing. So you have like a cool thing that's happening. I would have been more invested in the Oilers if they weren't playing at 10 o'clock at night, because watching Connor McDavid do his thing is fun. But it's like, I got really, it's like, oh, the Leafs play in my time zone. He's going to try to do something that hasn't been done in 30 something years. Oh, that's kind of neat. I'll keep following along with that. But I could probably count on one hand the amount of full hockey games I watched this year. But I was tuned into game seven of a series between two teams that I don't like. When I watched hockey, I used to cheer for the Leafs, but I haven't watched hockey in 20 years. So it's like, I don't have any affinity for them, but man, I would have loved it. Boston on home ice getting eliminated, man, that would have been awesome. If they were playing the Habs, if they were playing, I used to hate the Ottawa Senators because of what them and the Leafs would always mean to play. You know what I mean? Like, having a team in a league that you can dislike, I think is good for the sport. And I think if there's like, because right now Winnipeg's kind of that in the CFL. I think people are sick of seeing them get to the Grey Cup. And I think that that's fair. But if there's a team, they're not the Yankees. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the Yankees go out and they spend, and the Dodgers are like this now. They spend $1 billion on player contracts. And you're just like, God, I want to see them lose. Now, more often than not, they do win. But it's been a hell of a long time since the Yankees have won a World Series. And the only one the Dodgers have won in the last like 40 something years was the COVID shortened season. And a lot of my baseball loving friends are like, I mean, it counts, but does it count? So I think if you can build up a team, and if the, it makes more sense for the Argos to do this than anybody else, because they're in the big city that people hate anyway. Like, everyone hates Toronto across the country. Toronto just wants to be America. So it kind of unifies the rest of the country against them. They're the center of the universe and all that stuff. Man, if their football team was just like, to hell with it, we're going to spend $8 million on players this year. We're going to buy all the best players. We're going to try to go undefeated. I think it would be great for the league. I don't necessarily know if it would be great for us as Ticat fans.
I'm sure we'd be pissed off.
I'd be incredibly pissed off. But at the same time, I'd be like, kind of dig that they're doing that, because now you have the villain that everyone wants to topple.
Not only would it be good for Toronto as a whole, like bringing in fans to their games, but they'd be a traveling show. You know what I mean? Yep. Like, it would bring in fans.
The 91 Argos are a perfect example of this, are they not?
Exactly. You know, John Candy going from city to city, and, you know, obviously they wouldn't have that, but if they were the big bad villains that spent $10 million, spent $5 million over the cap, and they were winning year in, year out, and they were the bad boys of the league, and everyone hated them, they would draw fans in Edmonton and Saskatchewan and Winnipeg and BC and all those cities, right? So I think it'd be a brilliant move by the Argonauts and MLSE just to say, screw the salary cap. We have all this money. We're richer than God. Let's spend $10 million on the salary cap. I think that would probably help out the team, help out with their attendance. They're already the villains now for like terrible reasons that aren't going to make them any money. You might as well be a villain in a good way.
That's kind of the way. And maybe this is the pro wrestling fandom in us. We always got to find the heel to the baby faces, right? And it's always that dominant years-long champion that just the reign of terror. You want to see him go down. But I don't know. Everything relates back to wrestling, quite frankly. Nothing beats that type of atmosphere of a pro wrestling thing. So adding that to the CFL with your big bad, I just think makes a lot of sense. Now, I will say this. It's never going to happen. It is never going to happen, but
too much of a risk for MLSE. Yeah. Like,
well, because it could backfire. Because what if you do that and you suck? Because do you remember? And
nobody shows up still.
And no one shows up. Like, you're still getting 13,000 fans at the game. You're finishing 8-10. Because I mean, the one year the Argos did go over the cap, they didn't get fined for it because, well, it was the COVID year, but they went over the cap in 2019 and stunk. 2019, they stunk, but they went over the cap, but the league was like, it's okay, you don't have to pay anything. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I'm just saying, it doesn't, just because you spend all that money, the Ticats, it was $2,600, but they spent over, didn't really help them in the win column all that much. So You never know. But I mean, maybe if you're spending that much over, maybe it would. But unfortunately, we're never going to see it. It just it'll only be in our minds that we'll get that. So that was Podski Wee Wee for this week. I'm Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.
Eat 'em raw.